This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urges Muslim states to help protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque against growing Israeli acts of desecration. Playing down a U.S. plan of military deployment to the Strait of Hormuz, Iran warns that nobody is able to pose a threat against it. Also in the headlines, heavy fighting reported in Ukraine's Kharkiv region. Russia says it has captured a railway station. Good to have you with us. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has urged Muslim and Arab states to help protect Al-Aqsa Mosque in the face of Israeli desecration of Islam's third holiest site. Hamas has said that it hopes the Islamic world would take responsibility and protect the mosque. The Palestinian group highlighted the repeated incursion of Israeli settlers into Al-Aqsa, which it says provokes the feelings of Muslims. It also called on the international community to help stop Israeli violation of the site, stressed that the Palestinians will keep defending their land and holy sites. Earlier in the morning, dozens of Israeli settlers broke into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and performed their rituals. Non-Muslims are allowed to visit the compound, but they, including Jews, are prohibited from engaging in religious rituals there. Israeli settlers, however, usually storm the Islamic site under the protection of the regime forces. Palestinian activist and journalist Wafa al-Udaini joined us from Gaza City to tell us more about the Israeli violation of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today, it's really a provocation, what happened in Al-Aqsa Mosque. And actually, it has become a daily basis that the Israeli settlers invade Al-Aqsa Mosque and perform their Talmudic prayers inside Al-Aqsa Mosque. Actually, this thing is really a provocation, not only to Palestinians, but to all Muslims around the world. And it's really, as you know, it's a violation of a freedom of worship and to the sanctity of holy places. We can say, in fact, it's not a mere prayer. For others, they think that it's just a prayer and that's it. But it constitutes as unprecedented attack on the Palestinian religious rights of not only the Palestinians, but all Muslims nations. Indeed, all of the Muslim countries should be united against this oppression and what is happening in Al-Aqsa Mosque, because those prayers actually mean to change the status quo here in particular in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then it will be easy for them to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque and turn it to another Al-Haram Al-Ibrahimi, in Hebron, in Al-Khalil. You know that they turned part of Al-Haram Al-Ibrahimi, Al-Ibrahimi Mosque, they turned it into part of it to a synagogue.
The Israeli regime has carried out yet another airstrike on Syria, despite repeated warnings by Damascus. The Syrian military says its air defenses confronted barrages of Israeli missiles from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. The missiles targeted some positions in the vicinity of Damascus, killing two soldiers. Material damage was caused as well. The Syrian military says it shot down most of the missiles. The Israeli regime routinely targets areas in Syria, particularly in and around the capital, Damascus. Syria has repeatedly called on the UN to make Israel end the attacks. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mehmet Ali, joined us earlier with more details about the latest Israeli attacks on Syria.
It seems that, according to some images posted online of fire that broke out due to such attacks, the attacks hit perhaps a Syrian military target in an area called Qudsiyah suburbs, which is in Damascus countryside. Now, definitely, this is not the first attack, Israeli attack of its kind on Syria. There is still no comment from the Israeli side. Usually, they don't comment on each attack they carry out. But the Syrian army, of course, the Syrian army is not surprised by such an attack. And definitely, we always hear from the Syrian foreign ministry following such attacks, letters being sent to the UN condemning such an aggression and calling on the international community to condemn also, and on the UN body to perhaps shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security. But up till this moment, and after hundreds of Israeli attacks, there is still silence from the international community. No step or condemnation whatsoever was made following such attacks.
On to other news. The Islamic Republic of Iran has actually issued a threat to one of its generals. The Iranian defense minister has shrugged off this U.S. decision to dispatch fighter jets and naval assets to the Strait of Hormuz and the Sea of Oman. Brigadier General Ashtiani has stressed that Iran will not allow anyone to threaten it. Tehran has lambasted the U.S. move in the Persian Gulf as destabilizing and provocative. Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani says that Iran is powerful enough that nobody would dare to threaten it. The general added that the Islamic Republic has even utilized its military might to play regional and international roles. The Ministry of Defense is interacting with knowledge-based companies in various fields, including navigation, helicopters, and ground combat, to support the armed forces. He also mentioned Iran as a major drone power in the world and stressed equipping the military with advanced weaponry remains on the country's agenda. Moving on now to Ukraine, where heavy fighting rages in the northeastern Kharkiv region. Russia says it has captured a railway station there. Moscow has also conducted a fresh series of airstrikes on the southern port city of Odessa for a second night in a row. That followed a pledge of retaliation by Russia after it accused Ukraine of attacking the Crimea Bridge on Monday. In the meantime, Moscow has refused to extend a grain deal with Ukraine, arguing that parts of the deal concerning Russian exports have not been fulfilled. Also, a fire has broken out at a military base in Crimea, forcing the evacuation of locals and the closure of a major highway. The Moscow-installed governor of Crimea says more than 2,000 people have been evacuated and a highway is partially closed. Following that, Ukraine has said it has conducted a successful operation in Crimea. Johnny Miller in Moscow says the latest attack on Odessa has been the biggest since the war in Ukraine began.
Well, this is a major attack. We understand the biggest attack on the city of Odessa since the war began. A video is coming out of local residents filming some of the quite terrifying film videos of missiles landing near people's apartment blocks. This attack looks like it's connected with the end of the grain deal. Of course, Ukraine hit the Kerch Bridge the next day. We expect it was planned that anyway that Russia ended its participation in the grain deal, and I suspect that these attacks on Odessa are linked to that. Russia hasn't hit Odessa very hard because of the grain deal, because of the grain coming out of the major port city of Odessa. Now, with the grain deal ended, Russia seems able to strike targets in the port at will because of that deal ending. So we expect that that's connected, the end of the grain deal, to these major strikes. And another indication that Russia can step up attacks in Odessa and elsewhere in Kiev if it chooses to, if it has the political will to do so. So major attacks on Odessa, whether they're in response to the Kerch Bridge or just simply because of the grain deal has ended and they're able to launch these attacks. But major developments in Odessa overnight, and we'll wait to see whether more attacks are launched tonight.
South Africa says the Russian president will not attend the upcoming summit of the BRICS group of emerging economies amid the dilemma over enforcing his arrest warrant. According to the South African presidency, the announcement followed an agreement between the two sides. According to the Kremlin, Putin will take part in the summit via a video call. That ends a dilemma over South Africa's obligation to enforce an arrest warrant issued for Putin by the International Criminal Court. South Africa is a member of the ICC. The court issued the warrant in March for alleged unlawful deportation of children from Ukraine. Russia said it brought the children to the country as part of a humanitarian campaign to protect orphans and those abandoned in the war zone. It also dismissed the warrant as legally void. South Africa has adopted a neutral stance in the Ukraine war, angering Kiev's Western allies. Calls for peace negotiations to end the conflict in Ukraine overshadow a summit of leaders from the EU, Latin America, and the Caribbean in Brussels. However, heads of governments from the 27-nation bloc made it clear that they will not alter their strategy of sending deadly weapons to the war zone. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
50 leaders from the EU and CELAC countries gathered in Brussels on Monday and Tuesday in what was the first summit of its kind for 8 years. CELAC consists of 33 nations in Latin America and the Caribbean. Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, is currently CELAC president. He says the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia have brought misery to millions of citizens.
Rising prices, shortages of goods, and it's not just the war. It's the sanctions upon the war, the price of fuel, of food, borrowing of monies and so on.
Gonsalves certainly wasn't the only leader to tell EU decision makers that peace negotiations are needed to end the war in Ukraine.
La guerra de Ucrania.
The war in Ukraine must come to an end. The European Union and CELAC must, as an obligation, look for a way towards peace. We cannot live with this nightmare that any day now may see all hell break loose on all of us.
It was clearly an uncomfortable event for EU leaders as they wanted to focus on securing new energy supplies and critical raw materials in order to further isolate Russia and become less dependent on China. The visiting leaders refused to blindly follow the EU's anti-Russia rhetoric, analysts point out.
They're much more willing to call out what they see as the hypocrisy of great powers, you know, talking about other great powers and how they bully small states, given the histories of colonialism and American imperialism within Latin America.
The EU did manage to sign trade deals with Chile, Argentina and Uruguay on the sidelines of the summit. However, the relentless criticism of the 27-nation bloc support for the war continued.
The world has spent $2.24 trillion to fuel the war machine that only causes death, destruction and even more hunger. This summit is a way for us to say enough with that. Another world is possible.
Not only have calls here on EU leaders to facilitate peace negotiations fallen on deaf ears, but later this week EU foreign ministers will meet to agree on ways to apply more pressure on Russia while providing additional support to Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
China calls for meaningful dialogue as tensions mount on the Korean Peninsula in the wake of the arrival of a U.S. nuclear submarine there and North Korea's missile launches.
The situation on the Korean Peninsula has once again become tense, and the main reason behind this is clear. The relevant parties exploit the peninsula issue for their own selfish geopolitical interests, escalating tensions in the region and harming the denuclearization process, and the relevant trends are a cause for concern. We hope that the relevant parties will continue in the direction of political settlement, address each other's legitimate concerns in a balanced way through meaningful dialogue, and safeguard the peace and stability of the peninsula.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson described the situation on the peninsula as concerning. The statement came after North Korea test-fired two more ballistic missiles that landed near Japan's territorial waters. Pyongyang said that the launch was in response to a visit by a U.S. submarine to South Korea. Washington and Seoul have intensified their military cooperation in recent months, causing provocations on the peninsula. The North castigated the deployment and warned against any, quote, foolish acts by Washington. Meanwhile, a U.S. soldier has crossed into North Korea and is believed to be in custody there, which has created fresh crisis between Pyongyang and Washington. Canada is also struggling with its worst-ever wildfire season, with blazes raging in large parts of the country. Alberta province is the hardest hit.
To date, since January 1st, we've had 864 wildfires here in the province. We have burned more than 1.7 million hectares. Our closest thing that we have on record was in 1981, when we had burned just over 1.3 million. So this has been a record-setting year for us. We've seen unprecedented conditions here in the spring, and we will feel the effects of that for the months to come.
Footage shows smoke-choked air across Canada. Hundreds of wildfires are scorching British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and the Northwestern Territories in the west, as well as Ontario, Quebec, and Nova Scotia in the east. Thousands of people have been evacuated, and thousands more remain under evacuation alerts, as over half of the blazes are said to be out of control. Two firefighters have died tackling the blazes, one in the Northwest Territories and another in British Columbia. Authorities now plan to deploy armed forces. Wildfires have consumed over 10 million hectares so far this year. Smoke from Canada's wildfires has also blanketed skies over large parts of the U.S. Millions of Americans are under air quality advisories. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bazaar.
No matter where you're from or who you are, one thing that brings people together is a good meal. Everyone has a favorite food. It's a great way to connect with others, experience culture, and explore new flavors. And the food industry caters to our tastes, which is the main driver for the expansion of this sector. The food industry is made up of a complex network of activities related to farming, production, supply, and a host of services and products. So it's no surprise that this sector also plays a significant role in the economic development of any nation.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. This week, we will venture through Iran's food industry while shining the spotlight on meat production. We will explore this industry's contributions to the national economy.
We wanted to learn more about the journey meat products take to finally reach grocery store shelves and dinner tables. So to become more familiar with food production, we visited a meatpacking business on the outskirts of the capital, Tehran. This particular producer was established 15 years ago and has become a familiar name in the industry. The meatpacking market is composed of many sectors within the market. One of the primary concerns for any company packaging meat is the ability to deliver fresh products to consumers. This can happen in various ways and is heavily dependent on the type of meat that will be packaged. For example, this company has several production halls dedicated explicitly to particular activities, because not all meat comes in the same size or can be handled with the same machine. There are different production halls for each meat type. Red meats, such as lamb and cow, require larger machines and more space, while poultry, such as chicken, require smaller machines comprising closed-circuit production lines. But why does this company use a closed-circuit production line? This ensures the meat passing through each stage is kept cool and free of foreign contaminants. More importantly, such a process guarantees that each item is uniformly cut and packaged while maintaining sanitary conditions crucial for quality and safety. Now, the modern food industry uses a wide variety of sophisticated technologies, making production more efficient. It has also reduced menial human labor, freeing up hands for other, more complex tasks. In case you didn't know, and many don't, Iran has indigenized a lot of technology and machinery needed in the food industry. Moreover, these machines play a crucial role in maintaining food quality and safety. For most companies in the food industry, the high quality output is deeply hinged on the raw material they use. In the case of this company, they use free-range livestock that is pasture-fed from some of the most famous animal-rearing regions of the country. While most meatpacking companies have their own slaughterhouses, this one maintains contracts with livestock farmers who slaughter the animals before sending them to the packing company. The food industry is one of the most heavily regulated sectors in the nation. That is because quality and safety are important aspects for consumers. This company makes its products along the lines of Iran's Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the National Standards Bureau. It has also received international certificates for production and safety, meaning it can easily export its products too. Additionally, this company has created numerous job opportunities for the community while maintaining the highest production standards. What makes a company stand out among others in this highly competitive industry is not only the quality of products, but also the services it provides to its consumers. While the food industry has not been directly sanctioned by the United States, these harsh measures have hindered international banking and money transfers. This means many in this sector cannot import important machine components, which are still not locally manufactured. The basis of the food industry has always been agricultural production. Without the output of this sector, the food industry would not thrive as it does now. That's why Iran has a very robust agrarian industry. But agriculture is not limited to farming alone. It also includes livestock rearing, dairy, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Plus, exports from this strategic industry have also generated millions in foreign revenues, contributing to the national economy. First, let's look at the country's meat production as a whole. Based on the National Livestock Exporters Assembly, domestic needs for red meat roughly stands at 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, the country had 72 million heads of these animals, meaning 12 million were surplus and could be used for various exports. According to official figures, this year, 51,000 tons of red meat were produced up to the month of May alone. However, not all livestock are raised for their meat. They are also used for dairy production. Looking at statistics from Iran's Customs Administration, roughly $800 million of raw milk is exported annually. Next, we have the agriculture sector, which mainly produces raw materials for other food production. Data from the Customs Administration shows that some 7 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported last year. This amount was worth nearly $5 billion and reveals an 8% growth in export values compared to 2020. Looking more closely at these exports, around half of this revenue was raked in by 10 major agricultural products. The undisputed king of all agricultural exports is saffron, which brought $1 billion in trade. Next came pistachios, valued at $540 million, followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of value. Following the success of the first industrial park in 1890, more of these parks began mushrooming all over the world. Industrial zones are viewed as an effective way of increasing synergies between industrial activities through sharing resources. Furthermore, they drive commerce and business for greater economic stability among global and domestic participants. These days, industrial parks are key engines for economic growth and financial security.
We are going to explore Iran's industrial parks. We will examine why industrial parks and estates are so important to the national economy.
To become more familiar with industrial parks, we visited one on the outskirts of the capital city of Tehran. It was originally launched roughly 3 decades ago and has since grown into one of the most densely packed industrial zones of the province. Spanning some 260 hectares of land, this establishment is home to hundreds of producers active in several production fields. So how does this establishment work and what makes industrial parks attractive to businesses? One answer is that these zones offer unique services that support investors and companies. However, one of the most important advantages is the large plots of land fitted with the necessary infrastructure for production and distribution. Each year, thousands of tons of products are produced here. Industrial parks also provide vast amounts of space to store goods, and some have their own airports and ground terminals for cargo distribution. But that's not all. Many industrial parks are also situated in economic zones, which offer numerous benefits to businesses while cutting some of their development costs. Additionally, there are other advantages to operating in industrial zones for manufacturers who are also exporters. These include softer customs regulations and certain tax exemptions, among others. As a result, exports from these areas have also contributed millions of dollars to the national economy.
Industrial zones are ideal catalysts for industrialization and economic development. They provide the infrastructure necessary for small and medium-sized enterprises to grow. These parks have emerged as the new super tonic for the unprecedented growth of urban business and commerce. But have you ever wondered how an industrial park is created? It's no easy task. Planning and launching one of these zones is considered an industry of its own.
We caught up with a holding company specializing in planning and developing industrial parks in Tehran province. We wanted to see how these establishments are shaped, executed, and launched. It all starts with targeting the appropriate plot of land. This holding purchases the necessary land, which sometimes can cover hundreds of hectares. This entity carries out its activities under the National Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization. This organization is affiliated with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. So, the holding links various industries with government executive branches and helps remove barriers for manufacturing units. Plus, it connects investors to businesses while handling some of the government's bureaucratic processes for national and international investors. One of the main goals of creating these parks is to support local production and increase exports. Doing so will save the country millions on importing similar goods that can be domestically produced. At its core, an industrial park is a portion of a city or land zoned for industrial use rather than residential or commercial needs. These places can be home to a host of industries and might have oil refineries, power plants, ports, and so much more.
The parks serve another purpose too. They are also meant to protect the environment, as industrial parks collect factories and other manufacturing facilities in an area outside of town. Moreover, these zones foster technological learning and innovation while creating jobs. Plus, such sites provide intermediary support for institutions while promoting interdisciplinary networks.
Their activities support market expansion and reach by providing services to companies that help businesses stay relevant in the competitive market. For instance, this holding company has sponsored various national and international exhibitions where companies in industrial zones can participate. They offer dozens of types of services to small and medium-sized businesses both inside industrial parks and outside these zones. It might be interesting to know that nearly every province of Iran has at least one of these holding companies that establishes industrial parks. For example, the holding company for Tehran province has already established numerous estates and sites over the years, but its activities haven't stopped there. As part of its future vision, this holding hopes to expand its activities, and one of its projects is launching more industrial parks focusing on knowledge-based production. Generally speaking, the number of industrial parks has increased by over 270-fold since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Presently, there are over 1,000 industrial parks and zones scattered across the country. Over 830 of this total has been handed over to industrial units. That's all based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. All things considered, Iran's industrial zones have a bright and promising future while offering lucrative investment opportunities with big profits. The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years.
Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the event. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services.
This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations.
All right, now is the time for me to take a little break here and give the floor to my good friend out in the field who has prepared a report for us.
What's going on, guys? Well, actually, it's been a while that I've been looking for a practical pair of shoes, and today I decided to come to the first and oldest industrial shoe producer in Iran and the biggest distributor in the Middle East. Looking around, I can see a wide range of shoes in different colors, and this is what makes it difficult for me to choose the right one. To be honest with you guys, I've always been excited to learn more about the manufacturing process of shoes. For this reason, I asked this company to walk me through the production line of footwear. So don't go anywhere, stay with me. I wanted to step right into the factory to see the production line, but I just realized that every little piece has a process here. Now I'm in the designing room, and there's the thing that is called the last of the shoes, and it was really interesting to me to see how the shoes that we wear on a day-to-day basis is turned from to this. Now I'm going to give you an overview of how it is turned into the shoes that we wear. There's tape that is applied on the last, and to draw the design and create the prototype for different collection of shoes. And then it is sent off to stitching section to cut out the pattern on the necessary materials. And we've got different materials, different leather materials with different patterns and different colors. And finally, after the whole thing is approved, it is sent off to the production line. Partly due to the number of pieces used to make one shoe, constructing footwear is a true craft. The pieces needed to make the shoe are cut from high-quality leather, then next in the shoe manufacturing process comes stamping. In the factory, there are various departments that each performs different stages of the production process. When a department has finished their role, the soles are forwarded to the next department in line. Right off from the designing section, they get into the production line, and all the pieces are die-cutted. They are cut into different pieces to finally send them for gluing and stitching to ensure all the pieces are stuck together. All right, now it's time to move to the final section. Shoe manufacturing involves numerous steps to put all the pieces together. Assembling the shoe is the step in the production where the magic happens. Here, all the pieces, including the one that was just sewn, are fitted to form finished shoes. During assembling, the upper is bonded to the outsole. But before this happens, the insole is attached to the last and the upper ridge is placed on the insole to allow the shaft to be stitched to the wet later on and finally give the shoe its final shape. It's simple. It is not as simple as you think. It is such a demanding job. I call this stage the birth of the shoes because the pairs of the shoes are taken off from the mold to finally move on to the final stage, which is trimming. I'm gonna give him these shoes, and what he does is cutting out the edges of the shoes to be completely trimmed and sent to the other guy for buffing, waxing, and polishing off the shoes. And finally, they are nice and shiny, and they are ready to be boxed up and shipped out to customers all across the country. Well, what is so significant about this company is the durability and the guarantee of its shoes over time. So for this reason, I was so curious to see what the secret is behind this quality. Now, I'm in the quality control sector to see what happens exactly. All right, what happens here is after the shoes sampling are approved, they are sent off, like different parts of the shoes are sent off
from the production sector to the quality control sector. And there are several machines that each of them does is dedicated to a specific style of shoes. For example, formal shoes, athletic shoes, children's shoes. But now, what is so exciting, I'm going to walk you through, or I'm going to draw your attention to the safety shoes. Can you ever imagine a 20-kilogram weight falling in a horrifying manner on your shoes? That is something beyond my imagination. So I want to tell you today that this is the machine. It is called the Impact Tester that does the same thing. So let's zoom in and see what happens exactly. But of course, it's super horrifying, so I need to keep my distance. Wow, what a sound. You see, it's really, it's like a horror movie, the sounds that I listen, that I hear in the movies. So you need to keep your distance. And since the front of the shoes needs to be fully backed for workers who have demanding jobs in harsh conditions, this machine was created to, form or place this mold in the front of the shoes to protect workers from any sort of damages. So this is really mind-boggling, and it's really a lot to get my mind around. By the end of the day, around 1,400 types of footwear are sold extensively in this company's chain stores. This wide range offers various styles for people of all ages in the society, such as men, women, kids, sports, and as I showed you earlier, safety shoes. After I took a real-life tour into the footwear production world, I gained a broader perspective on how a single pair of shoes is actually made. Wow, for me it was really amusing to take a look at the behind-the-scenes of shoemaking. And now that I have all those processes in mind, it's time to see if I can find a practical pair of shoes. Alright, now I realize that there are so many factors that play a significant role in choosing a standard pair of shoes, such as the raw material, the comfort, the beauty, the design, and the color. What I appreciate most about this company is the fact that it offers a constellation of footwear in various colors. Shoes for men, women, children, and even safety shoes, as I mentioned earlier. And we've got sandals, slippers, and of course in different quality, we've got leather shoes, linen shoes, and just you name it. Among all these footwear, I chose this one, which I really loved the way it looks and the color and of course the comfort. I gave it a try, and yeah, I'm going home with this pair of shoes. And finally, I found the one that I was looking for. I hope that you got a better understanding of what a pair of shoes goes through before it reaches into your hands. I've been Sarah Dema.
That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
When your horse returns
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي
The ocean of dua
الإمام الحسين زيارة مني ونيابة عن والدي
Why did you leave us? I'm
to fend for ourselves. Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyaratu Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyaratu al-Ashura. So stay with us.
وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ ابْنَ مَرْجَانَ وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ عُمَرَ ابْنَ سَعَدْ وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ شِمْرَ.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing about this part of Ziyaratu al-Ashura. وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ آلَ زِيَادٍ وَآلَ مَرْوَانَ وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ بَنِي أُمَيَّةَ قَاطِبَةَ وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ ابْنَ مَرْجَانَ وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ عُمَرَ ابْنَ سَعْدٍ وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ شِمْرَ. May Allah distance from His mercy the clan of Ziyad and the clan of Marwan. May Allah distance from His mercy the progeny of Umayyah altogether. May Allah distance from His mercy the product of Marjana, and may Allah distance from His mercy Umar ibn Sa'd, and may Allah distance from His mercy Shimr. وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ أُمَّةً أَسْرَجَتْ وَأَلْجَمَتْ وَتَنَقَّبَتْ لِقِتَالِكَ. And may Allah distance from His mercy the community that laid the saddles of their horses, their reins, and took off to combat with you. In the previous years, brothers and sisters, we have explained up to this part, وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ شِمْرَ. Shimr ibn Dhil Jawshan is reported to have severed the blessed head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the plains of Karbala in order to attain reward from Yazid. History tells us that in the beginning he fought in the army of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam in the Battle of Siffin. But later he got deviated. He united with the renegades, with Khawarij. Since then, he always had hatred against the progeny of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and that's why he did such horrible action. His father was said to be Aus ibn A'war, who received his armor from Khusro of Persia, and after wearing it, acquired the name Dhil Jawshan. So that's why Shimr was called Shimr, the son of Dhil Jawshan, the possessor of the armor. He was among the Arab polytheists of Hijaz who did not accept the message of the Holy Prophet ﷺ till the victory of Mecca. We read in history books that on the day of Ashura, Shimr was heavily intoxicated with the love of the world. When Umar ibn Sa'd asked his soldiers to behead Imam Hussein ﷺ, it is narrated that none was able to do it save Shimr. So he announced himself as the one who is ready to do this.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is, do not allow tyranny. Do not allow evil doing. Do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah. He appreciates Him. He understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Dear listeners, historical records tell us that Umar ibn Sa'd shouted, "Who will bring for me his head so he would have what he would relish?" Shimr said, O Amir. Umar ibn Sa'd said, "Hurry up and you will have the greatest reward." Thereupon, Shimr approached Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who was in this state of unconsciousness. He drew near to him, sat on his chest, feeling the weight on him. Imam Hussein alayhi salam looked up at him and said, "Woe be unto you. Who are you? For indeed, you have ascended an exalted peak." Shimr said, "It is me, it is Shimr." And Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, "Woe be unto you. Who am I?" He said, "You are Hussein ibn Ali, the son of Fatima al-Zahra, and your grandfather is Muhammad, the chosen one." Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, "If you know that this is my lineage and root, then why are you killing me?" Shimr said, "If I don't kill you, then who will take the reward from Yazid? Who will take the reward from Umar ibn Sa'd?" Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, "Which one is more lovable to you? Reward from Yazid or the intercession of my grandfather, the apostle of the Almighty Allah?" Shimr said, "Only one portion, only a small point of the reward is more lovable to me than you and your grandfather." Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, "If you insist on killing me, then at least give me a sip of water." And Shimr said, "Never, by Allah. You will not taste a drop of water till you taste death in the state of continual agony." Imam Hussein said, "Woe be unto you. Unveil for me your face and stomach." Shimr, in this part, unveils his face and stomach, and he appears spotted and leprous, resembling dogs and pigs. And Imam Hussein says, "My grandfather was right in what he said." Shimr, astonished, says, "What did your grandfather say?" Imam Hussein says, "Addressing my father, he said, O Ali, a leprous and spotted person who most resembles dogs and pigs will kill this son of yours." This made Shimr furious, and he said, "You liken me with dogs and pigs? By Allah, I will slaughter you from the back of your neck." So he turned Imam Hussein alayhi salam's face, and he did what he did. So that's why we said that this Shimr was intoxicated with the love of the world. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين
بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.